This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The U.S. ambassador to the European Union testifies that there was a clear quid pro quo for a White House meeting between President Trump and Ukraine. After 2 weeks of impeachment hearings and more than a dozen testimonies, the president claims he was not impressed. At least he said so this morning on Fox and Friends.
This conversation was flawless. It was appropriate. It was perfect. It was nice. It was everything. And they even said that. They came out and said it. Now, compare that, and they try and impeach. And by the way, they've looked like fools over the last 5 days. These interviews have been, and these were their witnesses. This was the best they've got.
That was President Trump speaking this morning on Fox and Friends. Believe it or not, there were things besides the impeachment hearing that also happened this week. Democratic presidential candidates gathered in Atlanta for another debate. And in Louisiana, a Democratic governor was reelected to a second term. Joining us in studio to discuss this week's top stories are Gabby Orr, a White House reporter with Politico. Gabby, welcome to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Kraushaar, political editor with National Journal. Josh, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And Eva McKend, a congressional correspondent with Spectrum News. Eva, welcome to the Roundup.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this was week two of the public impeachment hearings. We're going to focus on three or four key testimonies. Nine people spoke. Many more people reacted to them speaking, but the show's only 53 minutes long. So we're going to do the best we can in the time that we have, starting with Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He testified on Wednesday, and his testimony was a doozy right out of the gate.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th. Days before the presidential call. As I communicated to the team, I told President Zelensky in advance that assurances to run a fully transparent investigation and turn over every stone were necessary in his call with President Trump.
That was the U.S. ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, testifying on Wednesday. Josh, I think the key takeaway from his testimony was basically like, yeah, everybody knew what was going on. There's no way that anyone could have been in the orbit of this whole transaction and not understood that, as he put it, two and two is four.
That's right. Sondland argued that this wasn't a rogue channel. This wasn't something that was being done against the president's will. It was done with the knowledge and, frankly, the direction of President Trump. And what was shocking, and what I think is almost pushing Democrats in something of a dilemma here, is that he pointed a lot of fingers. He pointed to Vice President Pence. He pointed to Secretary of State Pompeo. He pointed to Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney as having full knowledge, or at least partial knowledge, of what was going on. Now, they all denied it. But, you know, Democrats could try to get them to come before Congress to try to deepen, get answers some more questions about who was involved and really implicate some of the top level advisors to this president. That's not the way the process is likely to go. Democrats want to wrap things up more quickly. But the headline from the Sondland testimony is this was not some rogue foreign policy. This was directed from the top.
And Gabby, one of the things that I think Republicans were quick to point out was, or one of the things that Republicans were quick to try to do is to question Sondland's credibility. His credibility as a witness had kind of come up throughout. Republicans were quick to point out that the president may have directed Sondland to talk to Rudy Giuliani. He never, by Sondland's own admission, directly ordered a quid pro quo. So the credibility piece seemed to be the bulk of the pushback to Gordon Sondland.
Absolutely. And it's not just Gordon Sondland. I mean, they've tried to attack the credibility of nearly every witness so far. Of course, President Trump was tweeting during the testimony from Marie Yovanovitch. And so it's a tactic they've been trying to use. I was actually speaking with a congressional Republican last night who's been very involved in the impeachment process. And he was saying that it almost felt like Gordon Sondland, with his testimony yesterday, was trying to make up for things that he either failed to disclose during his closed-door deposition, and then tried to add in that addendum that we saw afterwards, and then tried to elaborate on in the public phase yesterday. And that just struck them as, okay, this person is trying to cover themselves from perjury charges, and we can't trust whether or not they're even telling the truth at this point.
That whole thing about him having refreshed his testimony.
Absolutely, yeah. And you did notice, I mean, at certain points during his testimony, you know, his opening statement, he invoked Pompeo, he invoked Mike Pence, as Josh was talking about. And then when he was asked later on during the cross-examination, well, do you recall the details of those conversations? He would often say, well, I can't be sure if this is what I said or if this is what so-and-so said. And so they seized on every single moment like that they could.
Yeah, Eva, he started to feel like a bit of a wishy-washy witness where he was like, well, maybe, well, I can't recall, well, they're fresh in my memory. But even right. beyond that, the process has kind of gone from no quid pro quo to quid pro quo to maybe a quid pro quo with the presidential meetings, but a quid pro quo with the aide. I mean, the importance of the transaction and the nature of how it happened and when it happened and why it happened, Eva, that kind of became a big part of particularly the GOP argument as to whether or not this is a big deal.
Right. And so he wasn't there, I think, to speak to anyone's particular narrative. He was there to say, here are the receipts. Let the record reflect that everyone was in on this, meaning so you can interpret this any way you want, you know. But he was going to say, if this ship is going to go down, I'm bringing everyone down with me, that everyone was sort of was on the loop on this. I think the opening statement was, and I was in the room this week for much of the testimony. It was shocking, but it broke down in the hours to come when he was really questioned on this and sort of waffled and didn't sort of stick to that that same gravitas that he came out with in the opening statement.
Well, and in the hours thereafter, we heard Sutherland note this phone call where he spoke to the president and was told very overtly, quote, no quid pro quo, I want nothing, unquote. And President Trump leapt on this as a kind of exculpatory statement, and he repeated it to reporters later that day.
Ready? You have the cameras rolling? I want nothing. That's what I want from Ukraine. That's what I said. I want nothing. I said it twice. So he goes, he asked me the question, what do you want? I keep hearing all these things. What do you want? He finally gets me. I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. This is not a man I know well. Seems like a nice guy, though. But I don't know him well.
That was President Trump speaking after Gordon Sondland's testimony. Now, Josh, that does not wash. Gordon Sondland was a donor to the Trump campaign. He was a significant donor. That's kind of how he ended up in this orbit. And the president, we should note, he was standing outside, which is why his voice is a little raised. But it was raised there more than it's usually raised when he's speaking outside.
Right. And it's important to note the timeline as well, because that conversation that he's recalling with Sondland happened in September, when the walls were closing in, when the whistleblower, I believe, had already made the original complaint. So the people were aware of what was going on in September, and that's when President Trump, for his own political sake, tried to walk away from what had happened. I think that was pretty apparent from all the testimony. You're right that Sondland, the reason Sondland's testimony was significant is because he was a Trump guy. He paid $1 million to get tickets, nice tickets, to the inauguration. So this is a guy who was doing Trump. I mean, he was the guy who had the channel, along with Giuliani, to the president. I think he said he had at least 20 conversations with the president during his testimony. So unlike some of the bureaucrats, the advisors, the people in the national security apparatus who didn't have that direct channel to Trump, Sondland really laid it out thick, and he talked about what his conversations with Giuliani were like, what the limited amount of conversations with the president were like, and he has more credibility because of that. Maybe he doesn't have credibility because he's trying to save his own
skin.
Yeah. Right. But I also think that he also has credibility because he has the least interest in trying to blow the whistle on this.
Although it's worth noting, Josh, just for those who may not be as steeped in kind of the way that diplomacy works, that even though he was a political appointee, and we've had some ambassadors on the program this week who made this point, political appointees in these ambassadorial roles are nothing new. This is kind of part of the way the game has been played. So in that regard, Sondland's not unique.
Right. The key point is that he gave money to the inauguration committee.
Right.
ambassadors often are political donors. The ambassador title itself isn't what's significant. It's the fact that he did give money to the Trump campaign.
And Fiona Hill, who testified this week, even said that sometimes, in some instances, it's good because it's a signal to the country that this person is really a close personal friend of the president, and it can actually help in diplomatic relations.
I thought, though, that this was Sondland was kind of the epitome of the swamp that Donald Trump promised to drain.
Right.
And that's what made his testimony so fascinating, is because, you know, here you have a man who, yes, before the reason that he got this role in the first place is because he was a significant donor. But long before that, he was a Romney guy. I mean, he wasn't by all means hugely on board with the Trump agenda, and found, though, that if he gave money, he could gain access. And he did. And then in that role, he sort of became the guy who was like, oh, well, let me just get the president on the phone. I can dial him up in a minute, regardless of the security concerns. And I was watching this testimony. I was like, this might actually be the most damning part of having Gordon Sondland sit before Congress.
We'll continue unpacking this week's impeachment hearings in a moment with Gabby Orr of Politico, Eva McKend of Spectrum News, and Josh Kraushaar of National Journal. Ken in Alexandria, Virginia asks, if Ukraine defense aid was not being withheld for almost 2 months in an effort to force Ukraine's President Zelensky to publicly announce investigations into 2016 elections, Burisma and the Bidens, why was the aid suddenly released within days of news that Congress was investigating the situation? Good question, Ken. We will get to that in just a moment. But also, we could use a little break from the impeachment news. So I don't know if you heard, the Grammy nominations came out this week. This song is called Light On by Maggie Rogers. The singer-songwriter is nominated for Best New Artist. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. And you are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the perfect gift for the woman in your life who is always on the go and loves a good balance of fashion and function. Rothy's are carefully crafted shoes made from repurposed plastic water bottles. They're stylish, available in a wide array of colors and patterns, and fully machine washable. Best of all, they're comfortable and have zero break-in period. Plus, enjoy free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges. Check out their seasonal styles at rothys.com/1A.
As the impeachment clock is ticking in the United States, Ukraine is in a race to fix a broken system before time runs out.
It's just frightening because it's fast.
A new look at the country on the other side of the impeachment scandal on Rough Translation from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Gabby Orr, White House reporter for Politico, Josh Kraushaar, an editor with National Journal, and Eva McKend of Spectrum News, who covers Congress. Rastus tweeted, "The president committed bribery, an impeachable offense in our Constitution. He should be punished to preserve our democracy." Josh Kraushaar, I'm glad that he used the B word, because the definition of an impeachable offense in the Constitution is treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. And this kind of gets, to me, to the case that Democrats are going to try to make, whether or not they need to amalgamate a bunch of pieces and have like one of those crime movie diagrams with pictures on a corkboard and string going between them, or whether they can just say, bribery. He bribed somebody. Bribery's in the Constitution. Kerboom, you're out.
This is where the politics comes into the equation, because Democrats for a while were saying this was a quid pro quo. And I think any fair-minded person can look at the evidence of the last couple weeks and pretty much prove that there was a quid pro quo. Democrats saw the polling, and a lot of people don't know Latin. They don't know what quid pro quo means, right? And they wanted to use the word bribery because it had a stronger political connotation.
That sounds like something your doctor tells you
right.
Needs to be lanced from the bottom of your foot. Oh, you got a bad, nasty quid pro quo on here. Let me just get some lasers in.
But it backfired. I think it actually may have backfired, because there is a high bar for bribery. You need, and Republicans can fairly argue like the bar may not have been reached. Quid pro quo was reached. Bribery offers a powerful argument for Democrats, but I'm not sure if Democrats made that case. And that's sort of the tension, frankly, between the politics and understand the legal side of these impeachment hearings.
Well, and Eva, the other piece of this as it relates to that charge that the Democrats and a number of other observers have tried to make is the difference between like a criminal proceeding and a constitutional proceeding, that the founders weren't so much concerned with like an according to Hoyle definition of bribery, but more the principle of the thing, whether we can't trust you anymore.
Right, right. And it also gives House Republicans an opening to say they don't have a consistent message. They're going from claim to claim here. I think it's easier maybe to just say this for that, right? I think, you know, rather than the Latin, mm-hmm. I think the clearest message to the American people is this for that, that there was an exchange right. or an alleged exchange.
You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, basically. Yeah. But that's a little longer than quid pro quo. It doesn't fit on like, it doesn't hashtag quite as well. Sarah emailed, why can't they subpoena Rudy Giuliani? Isn't he a private citizen? Is the president protecting him? Gabby, I think the answer to that is yeah, kind of yes.
Did you hear the Fox News interview he gave this morning? I mean, yeah. He was defending Rudy Giuliani more so than any other person in his administration. And again, this is a private individual who is acting as an outside attorney to the president. He's not a White House counsel. He's not an inside attorney. And so, no, it is striking given how involved Rudy Giuliani has been. He is essentially at the core of this entire investigation.
He has been subpoenaed, though.
He has been subpoenaed. But there's no way he's going to, I mean, he will fight that to the end. And he's also facing criminal investigations that have nothing to do with impeachment. So I think that it was striking to see the president go out on a limb and defend a character who at this point is just viewed as somebody who is operating with nefarious motives, somebody who has gotten the president into a lot of trouble. And that's not to say that the president wasn't, you know, knowingly involved. Trump and Giuliani are still two peas in a pod.
Well, let's talk about someone who did testify this week, and that's Laura Cooper. She's an official with the Defense Department. She told investigators on Wednesday, told the House Intelligence Committee on Wednesday, that Ukrainian officials had been asking about this freeze, this hiccup in U.S. military aid back in July. Now, Josh, what struck me personally, I think her testimony was one of the most important because she said that on the afternoon of July 25th, Ukrainian embassy officials started sending emails like, is the funding okay? Guess when the infamous phone call took place? July 25th.
Day.
Right. So it basically compresses the timeline that within hours of the phone call, some of the Ukrainian government smelled fish.
Yeah, she really established the case that, look, there were a lot of people wondering what was going on. And people were, she was worried that after a certain amount of time, the administration could be running afoul of the law by withholding the aid because there was a certain time frame where it had to be dispersed. So it just underscored the tension between, as Fiona Hill put it in her testimony on Thursday, the foreign policy channel, the traditional regular national security channel, and the irregular channel that was just at the time in July, they were bumping up against each other and it created chaos.
Speaking of the testimony, I want to get to Fiona Hill in just a minute, but we should also talk about Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vintman. We mentioned Gordon Sondland, who got his position mostly by being a big-ticket donor. Most of the witnesses this week were either career diplomats, foreign policy experts, career government employees, and that includes Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vintman, who is a National Security Council expert on European affairs. Eva, tell us a little bit more about Colonel Vintman. His personal story was one of the pieces of the narrative that kind of crossed over a number of the witnesses where who they are, in addition to what they do, was part of the story that was material.
Right. So he was born in Ukraine, but came here as a very young child. Immigrant story, an American story, a story of his family wanting to come here for a better life, deeply patriotic, Purple Heart recipient, and came and said that ultimately he was on that phone call. That's why his testimony was so significant, because he was actually on the call and was immediately concerned and went through the proper channels to report it. And so House Republicans try to suggest that he was unpatriotic. I think there was his lawyer has come forward and wants Fox News to retract a story that they did questioning his allegiance to the country. But I think that he was a good representation of a lot of the witnesses, career, nonpartisan folks who are basically were sounding the alarm for a while on this and felt as though this rise to the level where they felt compelled to come forward.
Here's part of the way that Colonel Vindman described the alarm that he sounded in his testimony this week.
It was inappropriate. It was improper for the president to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent, especially a foreign power where there's at best dubious belief that this would be a completely impartial investigation and that this would have significant implications if it became public knowledge and it would be perceived as a partisan play. It would undermine our Ukraine policy and it would undermine our national security.
It's part of the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. And Gabby, he was one of the witnesses who began to paint the national security question in this, bigger than just whether or not the president defied his oath, broke his oath to uphold the Constitution. He and a number of other witnesses said that this actually could make the United States less safe.
Right. And Republicans have struggled to respond to that, that particular argument that we've heard from both witnesses, but also from congressional Democrats who are conducting these hearings. And it is important to know, I mean, when you have somebody like Vindman and people like Fiona Hill and Marie Yovanovitch, who are these nonpartisan actors in government, I mean, bureaucrats who have been there for decades, who have worked through Democratic and Republican administrations, it becomes very difficult to attack their credibility. And that's particularly because of the wealth of knowledge and experience that they have. I mean, they would know if something does, in fact, jeopardize national security. And they're testifying under oath. I mean, none of these people have any incentive to be there other than to simply come forward and tell the truth and illuminate the concerns that they felt throughout what they were witnessing behind the scenes. And I do think that Republicans have really struggled to respond to that because, of course, Republicans claim to be the party of national security, of law and order. And here they have somebody who is completely dismantling the idea that this is a president who abides by those themes.
He also was one of the witnesses, and this struck me from when Marie Yovanovitch testified. He was one of the witnesses that drew applause.
Yes.
Like, there is a real, I mean, did anybody else know, like, some of these characters, Josh, have become very, at least to the people in that room, and we know that D.C. is a heavily Democratic city, but to the people in that room, Marie Yovanovitch got a standing ovation when she walked out of the committee room. Alexander Vindman, when he was asked, I think it was by Congressman Maloney, you know, what makes you feel comfortable and not worry about testifying? And he said, because I'm an American and the truth matters. And the attendees burst into applause.
Vindman represents what Republicans and conservatives used to cheer for, American exceptionalism. His family fled Russia, the Soviet Union, to flee persecution, came to the United States, served admirably in the military, won a Purple Heart, and stood up for American national security principles when he was aware of what was going on. I think what made his testimony so effective was, number one, his personal story, but number two, the fact that he was sort of, not only was he apolitical, but he didn't even understand sort of the larger political implications that were going on at the time. He was sort of focused on what was right and what was typical in his own judgment. And, you know, everyone, even if the Ambassador Yovanovitch, Fiona Hill, he actually made this point in her testimony Thursday. You know, the thing that she noted about the Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is that he almost wasn't well-suited for the position because he just didn't appreciate the political dynamic that was taking place around him, where, you know, he was sort of naive to what was going on in a way that almost gives a lot of credibility to his testimony.
Another aspect, though, Eva, in terms of Colonel Vindman's story is that the Army had agreed to supply his family with extra protection. So between that and also the fact that President Trump was tweeting about Marie Yovanovitch during her testimony last week, the question of just the personal safety, of the implication of the threat against these witnesses, came up again this week.
Yeah, their security a real concern. And, you know, Army stepped in and said that they were prepared, you know, to protect him. The president has a huge following. And so, you know, he's saying he's under attack and that the deep state is after him. And so people are listening to that message. And, you know, they have every right to be concerned.
Let me get to a few more of your comments before we move on. We want to talk about Fiona Hill in just one second, but let's get to a few of your tweets. So I Say tweeted, please discuss obstruction of Congress. With no legal justification, President Trump prohibits testimony and production of documents. Gabby, what about that? There was a place in Fiona Hill's testimony where she did invoke executive privilege. Some have said that because of executive privilege, they can't show up at all. They can't cooperate at all. Democrats have said this amounts to obstruction of justice. You're just giving us more articles of impeachment. I'm not sure where this week left us with regard to that.
Yeah, I mean, the White House, it's important to remember that all along they have said that this is an illegitimate investigation. And so that is sort of the crux of them saying, well, we're not going to participate in something that we view as illegitimate. So they have been somewhat consistent on that. And that's why you're not seeing the White House turn over documents and make available people like Mick Mulvaney and former White House officials like John Bolton, and all of those who have been subpoenaed or requested to testify so far. I do think that it will be interesting to see if Democrats include obstruction in the articles of impeachment when they begin to draft that, because there's been a lot of talk among not just the leaders who are on the Intelligence Committee, but rank and file Democrats who feel as though the president has gotten in the way of this investigation at pretty much every turn. And there are others who at the same time say, let's just impeach him on the idea of the quid pro quo, the idea of bribery. Let's not muddy the waters with other things that Democrats have talked about.
This was also an issue for Gordon Sondland as well, who said that the White House and the State Department was blocking him from receiving key documents that he needed to aid in his memory, to advance his testimony. So this is something that I think the House Democrats will use as well.
We got a lot of comments asking about obstruction of justice. We also got this one from Ken. Let me go back to that one from Ken in Alexandria. Ken asked, if Ukraine defense aid was not being withheld for almost 2 months in an effort to force Ukraine's President Zelensky to publicly announce investigations into the 2016 elections, Burisma and the Bidens, why was the aid suddenly released within days of news that Congress was investigating the situation? Good question. And that gets partly to the testimony of Fiona Hill, who was the former top Russia expert on the National Security Council. She talked a bit about her sometimes testy relationship with Gordon Sondland, which she admitted at times went a little too far. Hill told the committee that she realized after watching Sondland testify the day before her that the reason that they fundamentally disagreed was because, in her view, they weren't really doing the same job.
Because he was being involved in a domestic political errand, and we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged.
Gabby, it was pretty clear that her animosity, first of all, it felt like she was just holding back her animosity, that she was very upset about this, and that what Gordon Sondland was doing was not just improper, but the tone on the way she said it made it sound almost petty. Like, you're using this job for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it gets back to what I was saying earlier just about Gordon Sondland being this swampy figure, somebody who diplomats, career bureaucrats, people who have, you know, not only sacrificed their lives, but have put in the grunt work for administration after administration would view with such contempt, because he did just kind of slide into this role and is now behaving in a way that is completely antithetical to what any administration would want the people who are conducting foreign policy, overseeing foreign policy, carrying out foreign policy to behave like. And so, I mean, hers was probably one of the more powerful testimonies that we heard this week. You could just tell that she was dripping with contempt for people like Gordon Sondland with valid reason.
And it was powerful from the beginning. Her opening statement got a response from Devin Nunes, the ranking Republican on the committee, before she gave it, because it had been released before the committee hearing. Here's part of what she said in that opening statement.
In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States, and it plays an important role in our national security. And as I told the committee last month, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016. These fictions are harmful even if they're deployed for purely domestic political purposes. President Putin and the Russian security services operate like a super PAC. They deploy millions of dollars to weaponize our own political opposition research and false narratives. When we are consumed by partisan rancor, we cannot combat these external forces as they seek to divide us against each other, degrade our institutions, and destroy the faith of the American people in our democracy.
It's part of the opening statement of Fiona Hill. First of all, I think if I was at a super PAC and I heard her say that, I'd be like, well, dang, we're not quite that bad. But I do want to get to the idea of this conspiracy theory when we continue with Gabby Orr of Politico, Josh Krauthauer of National Journal, and Eva McKend of Spectrum News. Here's another Grammy nominee. This is Nice Things by Tank and the Bangas. Fans of NPR's Tiny Desk Concert may remember they won in 2017. They're nominated for Best New Artist. Stay close. You should do some nice things for me. Nice things for me. It's the weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please do take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find the show too. Thanks.
Saturday morning, your week was long. Your time is precious, but why not take 10 minutes to catch up on some of the biggest news stories with Up First, NPR's morning news podcast. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First, here at weekday mornings, and now every Saturday at 8 Eastern, too.
Back now to the roundup with Gabby Orr, Josh Krauthauer, and Eva McKend. I feel like this is one of those hours where I'm like, oh, we need another hour to get through all of this.
Seriously.
But we're going to do the best we can, starting back with Fiona Hill and what she said about this conspiracy theory, Josh. And I took her point to mean, if we keep propagating this theory, we are doing Russia's information warfare for them. And every time you say this, they're winning all over again.
That's right. Hill's opening statement was the most important part of the whole day because she made people realize what the stakes were and what the bigger picture is, which is Russian interference in both the 2016 election and future elections. And she was very concerned, very alarmed at the potential for further interference. And what was notable is that she was really bothered by Republicans arguing the Trump line, frankly, denying that Russia interfered in the elections and trying to pin the blame on Ukraine and this CrowdStrike theory that the president actually brought up again this morning. That's what alarmed her, and that's what she was trying to get at in her opening statement. And this speaks to I wonder if there will be a significant political impact just based on the nitty gritty of whether there was a quid pro quo. But if people view the president not trying to secure American elections for 2020 and meshing with Russian foreign, that's going to be a challenge for him politically.
Eva?
But House Republicans really resented her coming out and saying that they were promoting a fictional narrative. You know, a ranking member, Devin Nunes, waived that report, saying that they did understand that Russia did interfere in the election. They just didn't like the argument that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia in that effort. The problem is, even if House Republicans are saying that Russia acknowledged that, they're still also promoting this conspiracy theory about Ukraine. The president did it just this morning on Fox News. And so I think Fiona Hill is basically saying those two things can't go together. And if this continues, it really sort of corrupts the central message that Russia was involved in the major interference.
All right, let's try to sum up, because we do want to talk a little bit about the Democratic presidential race this week. Judy, with regard to Colonel Vintman, tweeted with regards to why his family immigrated, they didn't just leave Ukraine for a better life. Ukraine was part of the USSR. His family is Jewish. Jews were being persecuted in the former USSR. Jim in Maryland asks, please clarify, when did Ambassador Sondland hear Trump say, I want nothing, I want nothing? That is no quid pro quo. Where does that sit in the timeline?
That was, as we talked about on the show earlier, that was at the very end of the process in September, after the president realized that the whistleblower and other folks were aware of this back channel. So that puts, I mean, it wasn't, this was when he was trying to presumably cover his own backside to make it seem like there was nothing irregular going on late in the process.
So let's see if we can kind of sum up and see, what did we learn this week, kids? One of the things that came up a lot in the hearing had to do with fighting corruption, that the idea that the president would hold on to this funding a little while for, I think it was 55 days, to make sure that the Ukrainians were making headway in fighting corruption is par for the course, is the responsible thing to do. Gordon Sondland testified that his understanding was that the investigation didn't need to happen, but that President Zelensky just needed to announce that it was going to happen. Apparently, he was going to have an interview with CNN's Fareed Zakaria, and that's where it was supposed to be said. So, Gabby, where does this leave us in terms of the whole corruption piece?
I don't think anybody from the beginning of this believed that the president was truly interested in rooting out corruption in Ukraine, and the testimonies that we heard this week certainly backed up that idea, that the president was more interested in the optics of having President Zelensky announce an investigation into his political rival, into the son of his political rival, than he was about actually making sure that Zelensky followed through on his anti-corruption agenda. And one of the things, this is unrelated to corruption, but just in terms of summing up what we saw this week, there was one line that Fiona Hill said yesterday, which is that President Trump was essentially involved in a domestic political errand. That, I think, is going to be a phrase that we hear over and over and over again as Democrats start to craft their articles.
I'm sorry. I think you mean that Gordon Sondland was involved in a domestic political errand President Trump.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Thanks for clarifying. But no, that's a phrase that kind of sums everything up in a way that Democrats have really been searching for. They went from quid pro quo to bribery. And this was a catchy thing that they can use now in television appearances and the talking points that they're sending out and the ways that they communicate what we've seen this week to the average American voter. So I think we're going to hear more of that.
Let's wrap this up and then talk about Democratic candidates. We've talked a lot about the headway that Democrats have made in terms of building a cogent case for impeachment. Did Republicans make any headway this week?
Yeah, they did, because the name of the Republicans' game is to keep their base together, to prevent any Senate Republicans in the trial phase, assuming it gets to that point, from defecting. And, you know, I think you almost have to separate the substance from the politics, because it doesn't look like any Republicans' minds were notably changed. Will Hurd is the one Republican I was looking at very closely. He's a moderate. He's retiring at the end of his term. He was the only Republican who criticized President Trump throughout the whole proceedings all 2 weeks. He started out giving a presentation saying that he found a lot of what he was hearing alarming, and it looked like maybe he was getting to the point where he could vote for. And then he said, no, this does not reach bribery, the standard of bribery. Right. And that was a tell that the politics are playing in the Republicans' favor.
One last comment on this before we have to move on. Patrick asked a very good question. Patrick tweeted, how do we heal after the impeachment inquiry? No matter what the outcome is, it further illustrates how divided we are as a nation. The Democrats say the Republicans are spewing misinformation, while the Republicans say the Democrats are doing the same. Truth has become subjective depending on your news source. Even while I would strongly disagree that truth is subjective, that's why journalisms, I do understand where he's coming from. I've heard a number of people say that if you're comparing this to Watergate, these hearings blow that out of the water. This is different.
Yeah, and that's a really hard question to answer. I don't know. I think this process was extremely partisan. It illustrated that the country is very much polarized. Just building on what Josh said about Will Hurd, I mean, he was one of the few Republicans to say that this was inappropriate, misguided foreign policy, but still very much kept within his tribe, right? He wasn't going to break from that. And so perhaps that is sort of a good illustration of where we are as a country. And I'm not sure I really have a good answer on how we find our way back.
Okay, we got to keep moving on and talk about the Democrats. But I would say, if you ever find yourself confused and your head is just kind of spinning about all this, there's a great resource at npr.org/ impeachment. It's a summary of who all the players are, what the timeline is, all the relevant documents. It's updated regularly, npr.org/impeachment, if you just need the basics. Let's spend a few minutes talking about the Democratic candidates, Gabby, starting with former Vice President Biden. He certainly came up this week in the impeachment hearings with regard to Burisma and Hunter Biden. He is the presumptive frontrunner based on the polls, but he didn't seem to have a very good night. He stumbled quite a bit. He had some fairly big gaffes. I don't know how he came out of this week's debate.
I actually thought that this is one of the better debates that Joe Biden has had. He is no longer the front runner in terms of being the one who is receiving all of the fire. He's not positioned to have to deal with Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg attacking him consistently. It was sort of a mix of those top tier, that top four number of candidates going after each other. And I felt like Biden handled himself well. He did what he needed to do. But all that we've seen over the last 3 months with Joe Biden is just a steady decline in his support among key demographics who he will need to win in Iowa and New Hampshire. He is, of course, the strongest candidate in terms of his position heading into South Carolina's primary. But you can't go into a primary after ending in third or fourth or even fifth place in the first two. And so I do think he needs to find a way to make sure that he has momentum. And this debate was okay, but it didn't ensure that.
Josh, I'm interested in your sense of who the frontrunners are, particularly if Joe Biden kept his place, including some of the argument that was made by, say, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is now at the top of the polls in Iowa. Amy Klobuchar took a swipe at him as being kind of a local official, and this is how Mayor Buttigieg responded.
Washington experience is not the only experience that matters. There's more than 100 years of Washington experience on this stage, and where are we right now as a country?
So Pete Buttigieg took a swipe at everybody who's in the Washington establishment, Biden, Warren, Sanders, all of them.
Mayor Buttigieg is trying to present himself as a contrast, not just to the Democratic field, but to the president himself as a young, intellectual, military veteran. You know, if he wins the nomination, he oftentimes, and David Axelrod has said this many a time, the voter sentiment is against the president in power, and Buttigieg is as big a contrast as you can get. I thought Kamala Harris made a very important point in the debate, which is that the nominee is going to have to be someone who can recreate the Obama coalition. And frankly, I mean, she's not doing it, but Joe Biden is. Joe Biden is the only candidate that has shown the ability to build a coalition of African Americans, of whites, of working class voters that have traditionally made up the successful Democratic nominations of the past.
I'm glad you mentioned President Obama because, Eva, he made some comments about the race last Friday night that caused a bit of a stir. He seemed to be cautioning candidates from veering too far left. And he said of voters, quote, "They like seeing things improved, but the average American doesn't think we have to completely tear down the system and remake it," unquote. What do you make of what he said?
Yeah, I think he's, again, sort of scolding progressives, and progressives don't like this. They don't like sort of President Obama talking down to them. I think that that's how it's perceived. But he's basically saying that the party can't go too far to the left, that it's going to alienate part of the country. We were talking about Buttigieg. I think one of the really interesting things is that often it's argued that he's too inexperienced to be electable. That is often what they said about President Obama. Kamala Harris talking about the Obama coalition, but actually many of the references made to Pete Buttigieg sound a lot like the references made to President Obama years ago.
And Obama is a fairly wise political prognosticator, so I do think the Democrats should heed his advice in some ways. It's understandable that the progressive flank of the Democratic base would be angered by those comments. But at the same time, you know, I cover the Trump campaign mostly, and what they say they're looking at heading into the general election contest next year is the fact that they're going to run a campaign that is built on substance, because they think the president's accomplishments are the most attractive thing, and not on personality, because, of course, President Trump's personality is not something that most voters are attracted to. And what they're hoping for is to have a candidate who the substance, the policy agenda that they've outlined is just so far to the left, so unreasonable in their eyes, that it makes that contest easy. And so this, Democrats would benefit from listening to.
And briefly, Josh, also worth noting that because Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards was elected for a second term, kind of the second blow for President Trump in a month in a Republican-leaning state after the Democratic victory in Kentucky as well.
Absolutely. Two big things from that governor's race, African Americans showed up in big numbers, and suburban voters that had been very, very Republican actually voted in many parishes for the Democrat. Doesn't mean Louisiana or Kentucky are going to be even remotely competitive in a federal presidential election, but it shows how Democrats are both energizing their base and making inroads with those suburban voters, and picking the nominee who can do both of those things is so crucial.
I don't know about anybody else, but I have slept really, really well all week this week because after staying up and watching like debates and hearings and my brain being on, as soon as I hit the I'm out. I am done. But one more story that caught our attention is the Grammy nominations. We've been playing some of the Grammy nominees, and Lizzo, my girl, the singer, songwriter, rapper, she probably felt good as hell after leading the pack with 8 nominations. The Recording Academy gave 6 nominations to artists Billie Eilish and Lil Nas X, and 3 for the rock band Vampire Weekend. And with that, we say thanks to Josh Krausehaar, a political editor with the National Journal. Josh, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Eva McCann, a congressional correspondent with Spectrum News. Thanks, Eva.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And Gabby Orr, White House reporter for Politico. Thanks, Gabby.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Christopher Castano. We will dive into the international section of the roundup in just a moment. Stay close. Listen, if he don't love.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The United States reverses a decades-old policy on the illegality of settlements in the West Bank. Iran shuts down internet access in response to popular unrest. The leading Democratic presidential candidates face questions about their foreign policy in front of the cameras, and the Duke of York regrets his decision to put himself on camera. The Queen has now intervened as the fallout continues over Prince Andrew's ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Plenty to discuss this week on the Friday News Roundup, and joining us for the conversation is Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Nina Maria, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Moises Naim is a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, chief international columnist for El País, and the author of The End of Power. Moises, welcome.
Thank you.
And Rosalind Jordan is state and specials correspondent for Al Jazeera. Rosalind, welcome back.
My pleasure.
One of the things you should know, first of all, if all you've been following this week is the impeachment hearings, is that the U.S. is not the only country that is going through existential crisis right now. Israel is also in a pretty wild situation, and that's where we're going to start. Beginning with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he has now been formally charged with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. After that announcement, he went on TV and called the investigation tainted and biased.
לניסיון של הפיכה שלטונית נגד ראש ממשלה בעלילות שווא ובתהליך חקירות מזוהם ומגמתי.
Translation, tonight we are witnessing an attempted coup against a prime minister using false accusations and a systematically tainted and biased investigation. Nina Maria, let me start with you. Benjamin Netanyahu is Israel's longest-serving prime minister. He has a strong constituency. What is this all about? What are these charges dealing with?
Well, it looks like it's bye-bye Bibi as well as bye-bye Bebe this week, not just Washington's panda going somewhere different. And, you know, whereas Bebe was definitely very positive about the experience, Bibi is going down fighting. And you're right, these corruption charges are basically threefold, three different cases against him: bribery, corruption, and breach of trust. We saw a 63-page indictment from the attorney general, who, by the way, was political appointee, which is particularly crippling for Netanyahu, who has been a giant in Israeli politics and is, as you say, the country's longest serving prime minister. The charges revolve around Netanyahu and his wife, their relationships to some very wealthy individuals, and their demands for positive media coverage in return for favors. His lawyers in October fought pretty much tooth and nail to have the charges dropped. That clearly has had no effect, and we're expecting, I think, Netanyahu to call for a vote, or at least fight for a vote in parliament to give him immunity. And unlike government ministers or officials, the prime minister doesn't technically have to step down. But of course, this coincides with one of the most unprecedented political crises in the history of Israeli politics.
Yeah, with regard to that crisis, Moises, Israel is still trying to form a coalition government. Benny Gantz, who's with the Blue and White Party, kind of a centrist party, just edged out Netanyahu in an election in September. It was a redo election because he, Netanyahu, failed to form a government in the spring. Now Benny Gantz has failed to form a government in this parliamentary system, and the deadline for that was on Wednesday. They might be headed toward a third election this year. Why hasn't Israel been able to build a coalition government? Are things really that polarized and divided?
So the same question can be asked of Spain, who just had an election and they cannot form a government. The United Kingdom obviously has profound differences, and Bolivia also. So we're living in a world of deep polarization, of countries and societies deeply divided. And that is manifested at the polls, at the votings. And so all of these governments, plus many others, the list is long. Israel joins this long list of governments that cannot govern, that political parties that cannot build a coalition, that cannot find a national unity government that will take the onus of running the country. So this is a global trend, and Israel is one more country in that trend of very hard to govern countries.
Roslyn, I see you nodding your head to that.
Well, the only thing that might be able to save the Israeli body politic is that any member of the Knesset, or Israel's national parliament, can now step forward and say, let me try to form a government. That is something that the Knesset would have to agree to. That person would have 3 weeks to try. And if so, then it would be another 2 weeks to actually get the government up and running. But is that actually going to happen? I think a lot of people are wondering if people will stand forward who might possibly make it possible to impose some sort of immunity clause for Netanyahu to make it easier for him to try again to form a government. So I don't think this is going to be resolved before the end of the year. Certainly there is no appetite for a third national election, but there is this real deep-seated ill ease with the fact that the prime minister has now been indicted in what has been a very long-running case. These are not new charges coming up against Netanyahu.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about Netanyahu, whether he has to step down, but it seems like there's an option besides a third election where every seat is up again. You could take someone who's in one of the existing seats, Rosalind, and say, well, let me go at it so that we don't have to like all run again and have everyone vote again.
But can they bring people together who are from the progressive left, who are very much interested in preserving a secular Israeli state? Can that person form a union with the very conservative religious parties on the right? Netanyahu has had trouble keeping that coalition together himself. If Gantz can't put it together, who is the savior, if I could use that word, of the Israeli government right now?
And who is charismatic enough? I mean, one of the most interesting things about the Israeli case is what happens in a toxic environment when a charismatic leader, you know, his supporters fall out of love with him. And I think in the Israeli context, so many supporters of Netanyahu feel very personally let down.
And exactly. I think it's one of the things, Moises, that Benny Gantz kind of ran on is being the anti-Netanyahu is a little too strong, but basically being a very different kind of leader that's not as polarizing and that can build a coalition because he's closer to the center.
That's exactly right. He was running on Bibi fatigue against Bibi constant maneuverings that alienate a lot of people, but at the same time, he goes out and does whatever it takes to stay in government. And many people interpret that his need to stay in government is very defensive. He's not just just for power, but he needs to stay in government to stay out of jail.
One listener with regards to this asked, is this the end? Notice the Trumpian propaganda, coup, witch hunt, and investigate the investigators. Thoughts? Rosalind?
I took note of that language. Very much this is a very serious situation for Netanyahu. I could imagine some of this is a purely emotional response, but this is the kind of language that he has been using more and more since Donald Trump came to power, because he very much felt that he had a strong U.S. administration behind his leadership, and then it would be easier to carry out some of the policies that had earned Israel criticism, such as expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank.
What's this?
The caller is not the only one that had detected or saw these parallels. Elizabeth Warren tweeted the other day, Netanyahu is accused of accepting bribes, trading government favors, and manipulating a free press. Like his pal, Donald Trump, he'll stop at nothing to enrich himself and stay in power.
Now, before Netanyahu was officially indicted, and before Benny Gantz failed to form the governing coalition, the U.S. made a very pivotal announcement. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, announced on Monday that the U.S. would no longer consider Israeli settlements in the West Bank a violation of international law.
Calling the establishment of civilian settlements inconsistent with international law hasn't worked. It hasn't advanced the cause of peace. The hard truth is, there will never be a judicial resolution to the conflict, and arguments about who is right and wrong as a matter of international law will not bring peace. This is a complex political problem that can only be solved by negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking on Monday. Roslyn, some critics say that this is the death of the two-state solution. Is it that dire?
It's getting much closer. You consider that the U.S. basically recognized Israel's control of the Golan Heights, that the U.S. not only formally recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, even though the status of Jerusalem under international law is still a matter for debate between the Israelis and the Palestinians as part of a final peace treaty, if we ever get to those negotiations, and the decision of the U.S. to formally move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to much fanfare, all of these steps are really making it difficult to try to stand up a separate Palestinian state that is physically contiguous. The settlements issue is perhaps the most controversial, because now you are formally saying that hundreds of thousands of people are able to live in communities that are not integrated into the pre-existing communities. And it's just one more step, some analysts are suggesting, could now set Israel up to say, well, we're just going to annex the West Bank in contravention of international law, in contravention of numerous UN Security Council resolutions. That's the real fear.
Before we move on from Israel, Nina Maria, what about the politics behind the State Department's announcement that they no longer consider these settlements illegal? Does the timing of this week with everything going on in Israel, does that matter? Is there a domestic reason for President Trump to make this announcement? What about just the raw politics of it?
Well, President Trump is a specialist in distraction politics, for a start. So on the timing of this announcement, I mean, obviously, we're in impeachment proceedings, which has gripped the world stage. I mean, in some ways, President Trump's policy on the Middle East has not shifted. It's been one of the most consistent things about his administration and time in office so far. It's left many wondering, I think, whether this shift in U.S. policy, amounts to his great proclamation when he first came in of the deal of the century. I mean, is this it? Is this where it lands and where it ends? And I think it raises questions about the strongmen of the world. And going back to that relationship between President Trump and Netanyahu, he has basically gambled on what happens next on the Israeli political scene and what happens next to his great friend Netanyahu. And one of the lines I think we heard coming out this week of analysis, the U.S. Secretary of State pronouncement is a gift to strongmen leaders the world over. Well, the question is, what happens to policy when those strongmen fall?
Let's move on now from Israel to Iran. Amnesty International is reporting that security forces in Iran have killed more than 100 protesters in street clashes. Iranian authorities say everything is normal, but Moises, they shut down the internet access anyway, for more than 4 days in response to the unrest. What's behind these protests? What happened?
About economy, corruption, and bad policies and U.S. sanctions. All of that together has created a very difficult economy, a very difficult situation for people that are struggling. The bad policies are Iran has had very distorted policies that are not sustainable and that we are now seeing the consequences. The rial, the local currency, has gone from 32,000 per dollar when the deal with the United States and other powers, the nuclear deal, was signed, to 123,000 today. So that's a huge devaluation of the currency.
It's like a fourth of its value.
Right. And then there is people, therefore, see their savings disappear. There is no jobs. There is all kinds of very bad policies. But those bad domestic, made-in-Tehran policies are now combined with Washington-made sanctions that are biting the economy and creating, making the situation even more dire.
Yeah, Roslyn, how do these sanctions fit into this? I mean, the sanctions have put more pressure on Iran's economy. They raise fuel prices. They drive some financial instability. And I understand the value or the argument behind sanctions to try to get bad actors to do right, to make new deals and new arrangements, but I don't think that the people who put those sanctions in place wanted protests and violent clashes in the street to be the effect of those sanctions.
Well, the Iranian government is arguing that it is putting in new subsidies to help the very poorest of Iranian families, and it's increased the price of gasoline by 50%. I'm quoting one news report here. And that is what has sent people into the streets. And they say they've had to increase these prices in order to make the subsidies because of the U.S.-led sanctions on the economy. Iran's economy is still oil export-based, even though the U.S. government has said that it has used this money in order to pay for the development of its nuclear program, meaning its nuclear weapons program. And if nothing else, the admission by Tehran that the sanctions are having a dire economic effect is a win, if I may use that word, for the Trump administration. However, the Trump administration and the Obama administration before it both argued that they did not want to harm the Iranian people, that they were simply trying to put pressure on the government. It's now coming out that a government minister who is in charge of the internet in Iran has now been sanctioned by the U.S. for essentially cutting off the Iranian people from the world.
Sanctioned personally,
individually. So if that person has any assets here in the United States, he can no longer gain access to them. U.S. persons are not allowed to do business with him on the pain of themselves being criminally charged. But the U.S. has to look at whether its efforts to try to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapons program is actually the best way to proceed, because there are people of all ages across the country, not just in Tehran, who have taken to the streets to say, look, we can't afford to support our families. We cannot afford to live. We are not making enough money. You need to change what you're doing, because economically we're suffering.
Anina Maria, what about this cutting off of internet access? I mean, I don't think this is unprecedented. I mean, China has very restrictive internet access, but I'm not sure how that helps the Iranian government maintain control as opposed to just making the protesters angrier.
Well, it's a really fascinating comparison that you raise with China. There's also, of course, Ethiopia and Cuba, which are good examples of where totalitarian states have in the past shut down access. And it's an interesting case study, I think, if you look at Cuba and the way that they strangle, the government strangles the population and not being able to access. You know, it's very difficult even to get public Wi-Fi in a hotel. And you compare that to China, which has a much more centralized approach, and people do have access, and the Chinese people have embraced homegrown apps like WeChat in the knowledge that they will be under government surveillance. But nonetheless, you know, everybody is addicted to the internet in China. In Iran, it was always a decentralized internet system. There are only two gateways controlled by the government, and it's had an enormous impact. 80 million people shut off completely. So yes, there are reports that it's unprecedented, but there are interesting comparisons to be made.
Moises?
This shows a very insecure, worried government, a government that decides to shut the internet down, that has assassinated 106 protesters. We have seen protests around the world, and they are tragically, there are always fatalities. We have not seen that level, 106 people killed by the protests. The internet thing. So this is a government that is, in many ways, it looks like it's improvising, because it's not clear how you sustain the conditions and the policies that have led to these protests.
Let's shift gears and talk about a prisoner swap that came into the news this week. There was some relief for the families of two men who the Taliban had been holding hostage for 3 years. U.S. officials say Kevin King and Timothy Weeks — King is American, Weeks is Australian — that the two of them were released on Tuesday in a prisoner exchange. Both of them were instructors at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. They were freed hours after three high-level Taliban militants were let go. Nina Maria, where does this exchange fit into the larger scheme of the war in Afghanistan? There's this peace process to try to bring it to a close after nearly two decades that seems iffy at best. Does this help things?
Well, I think Afghanistan is going to be one of the big countries and the themes that we're going to be looking at in 2020 as these negotiations with the Taliban proceed. I mean, what's interesting about this hostage swap and this prisoner swap is that it raises fresh questions about negotiating with the Taliban. We saw a report this week by the Institute of for Economics and Peace citing the Taliban to be deadlier than ISIS in 2018. And it's always obviously shocking when you see the pictures of hostages that more or less the world has forgotten about, which was the case with these two academics at the American University in Kabul. But in the larger scheme of things, I mean, I think the strategy in negotiating with the Taliban is coming under real scrutiny, and it's going to be very problematic.
Well, and with regards to the Taliban and ISIS, Nina Maria, I mean, the ISIS has kind of been beaten back territory-wise. The Taliban was beaten back and then has resurged. So I think by some accounts, they are as strong as they were before the war in Afghanistan began, which it kind of lends credence to this idea that, you know, what were we there for, and how much does this help?
I think it's a very, very difficult question. I mean, President Ashraf Ghani, I think, had a very tough decision to make. I mean, he said it was tough in exchanging these hostages for these three prisoners, including a leading figure in the Haqqani militant group. He says and he claims that it was absolutely necessary to kickstart talks. I'd be interested to hear what Rosalyn has to say on that.
Rosalyn?
Well, I think it's one, it was a real gamble for Ashraf Ghani to do this. It was a gamble for the U.S. to facilitate this transfer. They made it possible for Anas Haqqani and two other members of the Taliban to be moved from where they were being held in Afghanistan to the Taliban's political office in Doha, Qatar, where the Taliban could then officially take custody of them. And the Taliban also had to release 10 Afghan security personnel. So all three countries are having to trust that the other two sides are doing what they're doing in good faith. And when there hasn't been much faith in the negotiating process, and we saw that being upended in early September when there was supposedly this plan to bring Taliban leaders to the U.S. to meet with Donald Trump to try to move this peace talks along. It's a very, very dicey situation for all three parties involved. I think what's also worth pointing out is that apparently there was some engagement by Imran Khan, the prime minister of Pakistan, and Pakistan has been criticized both by the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it for providing safe harbor to the Taliban in the FATAs, the federally administered territorial lands in the northwestern part of that country. It's going to take a lot to really unravel all of this and to get all of these parties to agree, one, to a peace treaty, but I think, two, the most important part is getting the Taliban to agree to lay down its weapons once and for all, because otherwise it will continue to be more dangerous than ISIS is.
Moises, let me come to you because we want to focus now on Latin America. We've talked some about the political insecurity, the protests that have erupted around Latin America. Let's begin in Bolivia, if we could. This week, supporters of the longtime but recently ousted leader Evo Morales clashed in the street with Bolivian security forces. The death toll since this violence began last month has risen above 30 people. Why is this happening, Moises? What's going on in Bolivia?
In many ways, this is Bolivia. That this is happening in Bolivia. And since the 194 years since independence from Spain, Bolivia has had 190 coups, attempted coups, and revolutions. Of the 65 presidents it has had, 13 had died violently while in office or afterwards. So this is a very politically unstable country. Some people have called it one of the most unstable nations in the world. And so it all started with Evo Morales, the president, who wanted to stay in power. And he had already been three periods in power, and then he wanted to stay. And he called a referendum. The referendum denied him that. He lost that referendum. Then he found a back door to be able to run, and he ran. And he was losing the election when the servers and all the infrastructure for the electoral infrastructure disappeared or was intervened. And all of a sudden, he shows up as the winner of the election. Clearly a fraudulent election, and so people took to the streets. There is Evo fatigue, and we were talking about Bibi fatigue in Israel. There is Evo fatigue in Bolivia. There is corruption. There is all kinds of unsettled politics and society. And Bolivia is a very long-standing, highly divided country. Through racial lines, and there are a lot of wedges in society with the indigenous population, with the poor and the rich, the people in different regions and so on.
Well, see, that's what I'm kind of wondering about is in terms of Evo Morales, because that's where his power base was, is that he was this populist leader who supposedly spoke for those people. And now there's an interim president, Jeanine Añez, who has asked Bolivia's Congress to approve new elections, select an official replacement. Is there support for that? Like, what does the path forward look like in Bolivia right now?
She has misinterpreted, in my judgment, what her mandate is. Her mandate is to just call free and fair elections as quickly as possible. She instead really believes she's governing, and she's taking all kinds of decisions, many of which are highly divisive, highly controversial, for which she doesn't have the power, nor has probably the legal authority to do. So this is a story that unfortunately is just beginning. And we are going to hear more, and I'm afraid that what we're going to hear is not good news, as there is this clash between the ousted president that represented the indigenous people, but and a lot of the population, including indigenous groups, are fed up with him. So there's more to come, unfortunately.
I want to talk Chile in a minute, but we got a question from a listener that kind of gets to this larger theme. We touched on it a little bit earlier. Sean says, it seems like there are protests erupting in countries all over the world, Iran, Chile, Hong Kong, etc. They seem separate, but is there any common thread running through these protests? Is there anything that ties them together? Nina Maria?
Well, the FT has done some very interesting analysis on this, connecting the dots between protest movements from Hong Kong to the Catalonian protests in Barcelona to Chile. And they went out and asked protesters, you know, why they were protesting. And they looked at different protest movements and which ones had an identifiable strong leader and which ones were leaderless. And it was a very muddled, disparate picture that emerged with many people in the streets are protesting for many different things. I think the point has been made that one thing that they do have in common, and I'm slightly stealing your line, is the unpredictability of the way in which they erupt. And, you know, out in the streets in Chile, people were saying, well, you know, I'm protesting about public transport, or I'm protesting about pension reforms. The question, I think, and this is perhaps one back to you, you know, why is it that these protest movements are happening now, and what are they all about? And in the Latin American context, I mean, again, I don't want to steal your line, but you make the point about it no longer being about left and right.
Yeah, they are about democracy and autocracy. A lot of these presidents are, in fact, autocrats masquerading as Democrats. Hugo Chavez was a leader of that, and then we now see it in Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. He pretends to be a Democrat, but clearly he is a very autocratic, dictatorial president. The other question, the big question, is why are all these protests in Hong Kong and Catalonia and Spain and in Tehran, in Iran, in Chile, in Bolivia, why now? And is this a coincidence? Is there contagion, or is there a big conspiracy?
Well, one of our listeners emailed, people are protesting that governments are not responsive around the globe. That might be relevant, perhaps, to what's going on in Chile, because at the end of last week, Chilean leaders from across the political spectrum agreed on a path to a new constitution. The agreement says that in April, Chileans will vote on whether they want a new constitution, and if so, how it would be created. But even with that plan, the violent protests there continue this week. Amnesty International accused the president's security forces of using what they referred to as unnecessary and excessive force with the intention of injuring and punishing protesters, and so far, five protesters have died. Moises, we heard a little bit about Chile a few weeks ago from our friend Fernando Pizarro at Univision. The Chilean government, I think, is considered a little more stable. The referendum isn't until April, but Chile's been kind of inching up to this with all kinds of like pocketbook issues that seem to have just kind of exploded.
And it fits a pattern. Internationally, what we have seen about these protests is there is always a trigger, a very specific demand. In Hong Kong was the law, the extradition law. In Catalonia is about secession or independence. In Iran is about the prices of gasoline. But then they escalate. The protests escalate, the violence escalates, and the demands escalate. In Chile, they started on protests against the fares of the metro, the underground system. And now they are demanding a change of the constitution. And even that was they have attained and doesn't seem to be enough to take them out of the street. The other pattern is that it's very hard to know who to negotiate with because these, as Anne-Marie said, are very often leaderless. There is not a clear leader. There's not a clear organizational structure. There is a lot. There's a huge role for social media and other means of organizing. And then there is the element of surprise. All these movements, all these protests surprise the government, but also surprise the protesters. They are also surprised by their success, by their support they get in society and others. So what is not clear is how this all ends. I think the caller was right in the sense that these are people that are trying to find a voice in societies where politics and political parties and the political process is not giving them an opportunity to voice their grievances, their demands, and try to make the situation different.
We should also bear in mind another nation whose revolutionary protest touched off from something economic, and that's America. I mean, the Stamp Act, right, with this tax on documents and newspapers, and when it was repealed, finally kicked back in the mid-1760s, that helped to fuel the movement that became the American Revolution.
Just imagine what they would have done if they had social media.
Oh boy. The founding fathers with social media. That sounds like a Funny or Die sketch that's just waiting to be shot. Now, in Hong Kong, those protests have started over larger laws, extradition laws, and the protests there are still escalating. So let's shift gears now and talk about Hong Kong. This week, a former employee of the UK's consulate in Hong Kong, Simon Chang, told the BBC that he was detained and tortured on a trip to China. Here's what Mr. Chang said happened to him back in August.
I've been shackled, I've been handcuffed, and I've been blindfolded, and also they make me hooted. And then they start the torture, for example, like the put me hands up, handcuff, and for several hours, and then you feel very painful.
That was former UK Hong Kong consulate worker Simon Chang speaking to the BBC. Rosalind, seems like this was already hard to see a resolution in sight between Hong Kong and mainland China. Beijing was not only not going to flex, but said, if you don't calm this down, we will. In light of that, torturing an employee of the UK's consulate in Hong Kong, I don't understand why the Chinese government would do that.
Sadly, it's not a surprise because China has long accused the US and the UK of fomenting the protests in Hong Kong, of encouraging people to go into the streets and flout what ultimately is Chinese control of the territory. And so to pick up a local employee of the UK consulate in Hong Kong and to abuse him is frankly not surprising. It may be shocking to most people, but it is not surprising that this would happen. What I find shocking is not that Simon Cheung has been able to come out and tell his story and say, look, this, I'm afraid for my life. But the way that the UK government has responded is not by giving him a 5-year visa, which would allow him and his family to settle permanently in the UK, since he was an upstanding and well-performing employee in the consulate. They've only given him a 2-year visa, which could force him to return to Hong Kong and ostensibly to more Chinese authority scrutiny, if I can use that word,
right,
at the end of the 2-year period. They're essentially putting his life in jeopardy. Whether that is because Dominic Raab, the UK foreign minister, thinks that there is a larger way of trying to exert influence to prevent Beijing from exacerbating or accelerating its crackdown of the protests, which Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong leader, has struggled to contain. That's a bigger question. But right now you have a young man who is very much afraid for his life, and he had gone to the mainland to do the consulate's work.
Now, how does the U.S. factor into all this? We know that there are these trade talks that are going on, and the Commerce Department's been trying to work that out, said it would grant some exemptions to its ban on the telecom giant Huawei. Mm-hmm. The ban prohibited U.S. companies like Google and Microsoft from doing business with Huawei. Mm-hmm. We've also had a bill to support pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong that passed our Senate on Tuesday and passed the House on Wednesday. Not sure if President Trump is likely to sign this bill, but the U.S. might have some influence to exert here.
Well, first, the president is expected to sign this legislation because it does, among other things, prevent the transfer of equipment that could be used by Hong Kong security forces against protesters.
I'm sorry, Rosalind, one more thing I should add. I should know that President Trump did speak this morning in a phone interview on Fox and Friends and said in part, quote, "If it weren't for me, Hong Kong would have been obliterated in 14 minutes. Unquote.
Well, he's trying to exert his influence, and I would imagine Beijing is not very happy about that, because Beijing has always made the argument that matters such as the protests are an internal matter for the Chinese government and should not be the business of any other government. There's not much that China or Iran or any other country can do about what the U.S. Congress decides to put forward. The Congress does have the right to make a comment, to pass legislation. The potential blowback is whether this actually scuttles the first round of trade talks between the U.S. and China. So it is very much a delicate balancing act for the U.S. But I think that if the U.S. is concerned about its stand on human rights issues, you can probably expect the president to sign this legislation, especially given that it passed the Senate, which is under Republican control. And they certainly have taken the position that they're only going to put forward legislation that they feel confident that the White House would approve of.
Usually, we joke that every week we have to talk about Brexit. Well, this week we are not talking about Brexit, but there is another story out of the UK that got our attention. And frankly, Nina Maria, I think compared to this, I think some folks would rather be talking about Brexit, because this is a bad one. It was an interview with Emily Maitlis, who's with BBC Newsnight, which is a brilliant news magazine on the BBC. And she spoke to the Duke of York, Prince Andrew, about his connection to the late convicted sex offender and financier Jeffrey Epstein. They also discussed allegations of sexual abuse against a teenage girl that were made against him, and that did not go well. Here's an exchange over why the prince chose to stay at Epstein's home in New York in 2010, where he had been the guest of honor.
If there was a party, then I'd know nothing about that.
You were invited to that dinner as a guest of honour.
Well, I was there, so there was a dinner. I don't think it was quite as you might put it, but yeah, okay, I was there at a dinner, yeah.
I'm just trying to work this out, because you said you went to break up the relationship, and yet you stayed at that New York mansion several days. I'm wondering how long...
But I was doing a number of other things while I was there.
But you were staying at the house of, yes, a convicted sex offender.
It was a convenient place to stay.
Part of the interview between Prince Andrew and the BBC's Emily Maitlis. Now, Prince Andrew stepped away from his royal duties. He may be asked to testify to the FBI. Companies and charities that the prince worked with have distanced themselves from him. Nina Maria, there seems to be no way to address these allegations that's not awkward, assuming they're not true. So I don't know if we give him the benefit of the doubt for being in a no-win situation, or if we blame him for just taking the interview in the first place.
Well, a bit of both. I mean, the allegations against Prince Andrew are becoming ever more explosive. And we are, I think, well beyond the point of ridicule. We've had other royal scandals in the past where the British tabloids have ripped into the royals, and they've been a source of comedy and mockery. But I think the gravity of the allegations against Prince Andrew make it very difficult to handle and absorb and analyze what is going on. And the media, I think, has some degree of responsibility not to participate in the mockery and ridicule, because there are real victims and women who suffered terrible abuse at the hands of the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. And it's very, very unclear what Prince Andrew's role was in all of that. And there's also the point that you make about whether or not he should have gone ahead with this interview. One of his PR advisors quit 2 weeks before he gave this interview because he felt so strongly that Prince Andrew should not be speaking out in public about it. And clearly there's this FBI investigation, or at least the desire by the FBI to question Prince Andrew. I mean, all of this to say that it is a depressing spectacle. It's embarrassing for the UK, I think, alongside the fact that Meghan Markle has also not been terribly popular in the UK press, and the reception of her into the royal family has been mixed. I certainly think that America's love affair with the royal family may be over, and frankly, it's high time that the British also look very carefully at their own relationship with the royal family.
Which is interesting, because Meghan Markle kind of peaked that relationship a little bit for a minute, and now maybe that peak has passed. Moises?
So the surprise is that you have a royal family that has been in the media for centuries, practically. And here he was in this interview, completely unprepared, completely befuddled by the questions, completely improvising and not knowing what to, you know. There were some questions that were obvious, and he seemed to be taken by surprise by those questions. So the surprise is, why was he so unprepared, let alone why did he take the interview, but why was he so unprepared?
One last story we wanted to talk about, and this is kind of a fun story, an interesting story, but also one that raised some questions for us. It has to do with your next hotel stay and the things we would do to get a discount. Would you be willing to stay in a hotel for a discount if it meant letting people on the internet watch you in your room? A hotel on the west coast of Japan is renting a room for $1 a night if you agree to have your whole stay live streamed. There's no sex allowed, and you can turn on the microphone if you want to. The owner of the Asahi Ryokan Hotel says he came up with it after a British guest live-streamed his entire stay. The average room rate at this hotel is $27 a night, so this would make it $1 a night. Roslyn, I am told you have thoughts.
I do have thoughts. I'm Generation X, just to set the stage. But I think we live in the world of... there's a camera aimed at everyone, everywhere, at every time. You're always being watched. We should point out that this hotel room does not have the camera aimed at the bathroom, so that you can do your duties in the privacy of your room.
That would help.
But when I see that everyone is streaming everything about their lives and about their friends and their families, it's really... I'm surprised more hotels haven't offered this. The flip side, I thought, okay, well, I have a little vacation time coming up. What could I do with the money I save on the hotel room?
Mm-hmm.
$3,200 premium economy on JAL from Washington nonstop to the city in Japan.
I hear you on that. Rosalind Jordan, State and Specials Correspondent for Al Jazeera. Rosalind, thank you for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
Nina Maria Potts, Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Thank you, Nina Maria.
Thank you for having me.
And Moises Naim, Chief International Columnist for El País. Thank you, Moises.
Thank you.
1A's senior team is Paige Osborne and Danielle Knight. Rupert Allman is our Executive Producer, and our podcast editor is Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, you can visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. And before we go, we made an announcement this week that you might have missed with the impeachment hearings. We here at 1A look forward to covering the 2020 election with the depth and creativity and engagement you expect from us. But that coverage will have a different host. I am joining MSNBC as an anchor. My final live broadcast from this chair will be on the Friday before Christmas, December 20th. This show is not about me. It's not about a person. It's about a principle. It's about speaking freely and finding the courage to listen. That principle will remain, and whoever succeeds me will uphold it as fervently as I have tried to these last few years. So, I'm leaving 1A. Headed to MSNBC, stay tuned for show details. But for now, thank you so very much for welcoming me into your homes, your hearts, and your heads. When I took this job 3 years ago, I was following in the footsteps of a legend. Diane Rehm hosted the predecessor to 1A, the Diane Rehm Show, for more than 35 years. Many of her longtime listeners have said they're grateful that this program has built on that legacy. Diane and her fans made this possible. She ended her run on her terms, raised a glass to 1A, literally, and left us to build what we wanted to build, and now it's my turn to do the same. I am eternally grateful to our production team, to the more than 360 stations that choose to air this program coast to coast, to the brilliant support we've had from NPR since day one, and most importantly, to you. So, until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.